Hi, I'm Dan Dunn, the host of What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn, a show that mixes history, culture, politics, famous people, and booze, and strains it through the cognitive mesh of my sozzled gray matter. Join me each week as I take a lighthearted stroll through the consequential role that alcohol has played through the ages, and how it shaped key moments in history, quite literally changing the world. For instance, did you know that Thomas Jefferson started the first U.S. wine company in Virginia with investments from George Washington and Ben Franklin? It's true. And if you're wondering whose winery sits across the street from Jefferson's estate today, here's a hint. What's orange, president, and has a very good brain and the best people. I'll also tell you about new stuff to drink, trends, recipes, and other things that are good to know. And I'll chat up celebrities, along with the movers and shakers of the adult beverage world. And since this is a show about alcohol, I'd like to remind you that drinking can cause memory loss. Or even worse, memory loss. Where was I? Oh, right. Plugging my show. It's called What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn. It's fun, I promise. So come on, pull up a bar stool, and let's kick it.
Welcome to Care Talk, where we talk about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America and answer your health insurance and healthcare questions. My name is Laura Packard, and I'm a cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, and we're here to help you. Please text or call in your questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get the next show. And now I'm pleased to welcome back Bobby Kogan, the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at American Center for American Progress.
Thanks so much for having me back on.
Thanks for joining us. So just to sum up what's happened in the last few days, the House passed a continuing resolution that would extend the current budget, the current federal spending, to September 30th. The Senate agreed to that, and the president signed that into law. So let's talk about what's actually in this bill and how it could affect our audience.
Sure. So the U.S. is a weird and bad and unique budget process. Most of the rest of the world, you put forward a budget that kind of deals with everything. You decide how much each thing is going to get that year, and then you vote it in. Or if they don't have the votes, then you dissolve parliament and you hold a new election until you can pass a budget. In the U.S., we kind of debate about 1/3 of the budget every single year. And then the remaining 2/3 is kind of roughly on autopilot ish. We might check in every few years on those just to kind of re-up them and tweak them around the edges. So what we just did was kind of the 1/3 of the budget that Congress fights about each year. How much is NIH going to get this year? And how much are the various individual things within it going to get? How much is EPA? How much is NASA going to get? That sort of stuff. And so, as you said, it kind of roughly did exactly what we did last year. And what that means, for healthcare, that means there are a couple kind of individual tweaks under the hood, but by and large, that means anything we're doing has the same dollar funding that it had last year. And what that means is that it's falling behind. Why is it falling behind? Well, there has been some inflation and there's been some population growth. You put those together, it means that anything we were doing in this space is able to do about 3 or 4% less than it was last year.
So this bill that's just passed, it extends the current funding until September 30th. What happens on or around September 30th?
Sure. So confusingly, the fiscal year doesn't follow the calendar year. The fiscal year goes October 1st to September 30th. And so this locked in the funding through the end of this fiscal year. And at that point, if we don't have a new batch of funding, then we will have a government shutdown. As I say, the shutdown really only affects the part of the budget that we are fighting about every single year. But if we don't have a new thing in place by then, either another continuing resolution or full year bills, then we will have parts of the government shut down, like we narrowly avoided just a few days ago.
So let's talk about the larger fight that's been happening in the background that maybe now will become more visible. So we've talked on this show a few times about how there is a potential nearly $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid on the House's budget that they're working on. Can you tell us more about what that budget process looks like, timeline, and how it's going to go?
Sure. So that is that's in the other two thirds, right? And that's why, since we've now finished the one third, we're now on to the other two thirds. The House and the Senate are talking amongst themselves, not super productively. What they need to do now is come to an overall agreement for the general frame of what they want to do. They don't have to agree on all the details under the hood, but they need to know kind of how large they want to go by committee. So how large energy and commerce, which has Medicaid, is going to be, how large finance, which on the Senate has Medicaid, is going to be. And that's going to tell them kind of what they're shooting for. And right now the House and the Senate are in a different place. And depending on the reporting you see, they hope to have agreed to a general framework by a month from now or even longer from now. They don't know what they're doing because their majority is slim enough and there are enough holdouts kind of no matter what they want to do that they can't figure out what they want to do. But then the next thing they need to do is agree on that framework. And then that'll key up the rest of the stuff. Once they can agree to that framework, we'll have another vote on the framework. And then they begin writing bills. And then everything can move very, very, very quickly if they kind of have their act together. And just to kind of put a pin on like how quickly it can go, the Democrats in early 2021 did the American Rescue Plan. That was the Joe Biden COVID stimulus bill. And that took about 5 weeks from start to finish. Now, in that case, almost all the details under the hood had already been agreed to, and Democrats were not fighting amongst themselves very much, a little bit, but they weren't fighting amongst themselves very much about what was going in and how large it was going to be and that sort of stuff. So they were able to just kind of write the bills and do what's called a bird bath to make sure that it sticks to the rules of the process that they were doing. But, you know, they did it in a month. This one, the difficulty is going to be all the politics of it.
So if people are concerned about what their senators and their representative are up to in writing these budgets, if they're concerned about these big cuts, how much time do we have to change their minds to not gut Medicaid, for example?
So I'd say at minimum, you have a month. And at maximum, you have, as you know, until they give up. There are a couple key steps in the process. They have to, as I say, they have to agree on the framework, which will require both the House and the Senate voting again. Then the committees will start writing. And that, you know, if they know what they're doing, the whole process, that process will only take a week. But if they don't know what they're doing, that could take longer. And then each chamber needs to vote on the bill, the full bill, once they kind of have figured out everything. And then the president needs to sign it. So that's presumably it's plenty of time. And the ways that folks can get involved could be calling your member of Congress or your senator. It could be attending a town hall, right? I mean, to the extent that they're brave enough to have town halls, it could be going to a town hall. It can also be something like talking to the governor, right? Even though the governor isn't kind of directly involved, the governor has a huge relationship with the folks. And since Medicaid is run by the states, the governor will, you know, has a very strong opinion about whether federal money coming in to run a program, you know, to help finance a program run by the states, you know, how it'll matter to them. And that was actually a huge thing in the 2017 healthcare fights when the governors were getting involved.
And going back to 2017, I honestly don't recall that. I remember the House passed a bill because they passed it right while I was getting chemotherapy. So I was very much paying attention to that vote the day after my first chemo appointment is when they voted to take away my health insurance. But on the Senate side, there were a few bills that never made it through, including the famous one in July when Senator John McCain voted thumbs down. So did they never get to the point where both the House and the Senate had an agreement, and then they would go forth and do the budget, which included the repeal of the Affordable Care Act? Or was that a different process?
It was the same process. There are just multiple times where they have to get to the same agreement. They had agreement on the framework, I think, within the first week that they gaveled in, right? So if, I think they gaveled in like the 2nd or the 3rd of January. The day after they gaveled in, they dropped a shell budget resolution, which is this kind of framework. And they just both agreed to it right away. That one, they left themselves tons of flexibility. What they said was, hey, finance committee, save at least $1 billion. Hey, help committee, save at least $1 billion. So they didn't say, okay, save at least $500 billion. And this needs, right? They didn't kind of do all the details. They just said, we'll figure it out later. Just save at least $1 billion. And that gave them the flexibility of what they wanted to do. Then, as you say, you know, what happened then was it took the House months to write it. They thought they were going to be done January 20th. The House, the committees wrote the bills, but then they failed in March, sometime in March, and then they succeeded in May. Then they sent it over to the Senate. The Senate moved to it, but then they couldn't figure out what they wanted. They went through a handful of different versions, and then they gave up. And so we're at this early phase that they had done within the first week last time. And the reason it's so difficult this time is, as I said, last time they left themselves flexibility. Here they don't, you know, some people don't want to leave them flexibility. Some people over in the House say, right, if they, as I said, last time they said, find at least $1 billion of savings. And that meant they could save, they could cut only $2 billion and call it a day, right? That would fit within it. Part of the issue for Republicans here is that some members of the House say that's not enough. I want to guarantee that the Medicaid cuts are super large. And so they're insisting on binding instructions that don't allow for that flexibility. And then another difficulty is they're also trying to shoehorn in tax cuts that disproportionately go to rich people at the same time. And so now all of a sudden you have a bill that would rip healthcare away from millions of people, and also cut taxes like disproportionately for the rich. And when I say disproportionately, I mean the average person, the top 0.1%, would get a $278,000 tax cut, right? So disproportionately going to the rich. And so they can't even figure out their framework right now. It was the same process, but before they can even get to writing the bills and then doing a thumbs up or thumbs down on the bills, they first need to agree on generally how large-ish they want to go for. Or they could agree to give themselves flexibility. But again, they'd have to agree to give themselves flexibilities. And some of the hardliners over there don't want the flexibility.
Is there any way they could go back, rewind, and do this differently, like in 2017, where they had a very flexible agreement? They didn't do that this time. Is there any chance they could give up on the budget framework that has very detailed instructions and instead do something more flexible?
So the flexibility, this stage is just telling the committee, it's not telling what they're going to do, it's just telling the committees, giving the committees instructions. Save at least $1 billion, save at least $1 trillion, spend no more than $100 billion. What gave them flexibility last time was they said save at least $1 billion. And so at least $1 billion, when, you know, the House produced a bill that was cutting like almost $1 trillion, but that is fine because $1 trillion is more than $1 billion. And so the Senate's version of this bill gave huge flexibility. They said finance save at least $1 billion. And so that's Medicaid cuts probably. And they indicated that it was partial Medicaid, you know, that it was limited Medicaid cuts. But, you know, they gave themselves the room for it to be very small. And what they said was, we just want to go after Joe Biden's nursing rule. And that's it. That's the only thing we want to do. The House version that they were, you know, that in order to get the hardliners, the House said, no, we that's not okay with us. We need it to be many hundreds of billions of dollars. They gave Energy and Commerce an instruction to do $880 billion. And there's just not enough money there that's not Medicaid. Unless you're cutting Medicare. But if you're not cutting Medicare, there's only about $200 billion of non-health coverage stuff in that committee. So it had to be huge, huge, huge Medicaid cuts. They could still end up with large flexibility. Like, you know, they are still at that fighting phase and they can change it. They could decide to not do energy and commerce at all. Right. They could decide to not go after Medicaid. So there's still plenty of time to convince them to eschew and forego Medicaid entirely. And there's still plenty of time for them to say, well, we'll figure it out. We'll do it live. Right. We'll figure it out as we go. But as I say, part of the internal politics here is that for some Republicans who are dead set on cutting Medicaid, they view this as their only leverage. They say, if we don't get it now, we'll never get it. And so they don't want to pass on it right now. And that's kind of where the debate is for them.
Thanks for explaining what's going on and what people can do, because I think most people would agree that cutting taxes so that Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos can have more yachts while ripping away healthcare from millions of Americans is not the direction that we should be taking.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say that the House, I mean, again, I hesitate to call it a bill because it's just a framework, but what the House was contemplating would, in all of U.S. history, be the single largest transfer of wealth from poor people to the rich in a single bill. Obviously, there have been tons of bills over time that can add up to things, but if you're looking at a single bill, what the House is contemplating, if it were to pass, would be the largest transfer of wealth from very vulnerable people to very rich people. It would take away food from incredibly poor people. It would cut benefits down to about $1.67 per person per meal, on average. And it would rip Medicaid away from millions and millions of people. It depends on how they do it, but the estimates are around 15-ish million people, depending on how they do it. That's a lot of people. And it would do all that to help partially finance a bill that would further enrich unbelievably rich people who will have more than any of us will ever see in our lifetimes. So I encourage folks to think about how that makes them feel and act accordingly.
Thanks again, because Elon Musk's super yachts will be fueled by hungry children and people losing their health care. And now we're going to answer some of our viewer questions and talk about other healthcare issues. So first, we'll talk about what the Trump administration, the actions that they have taken over the past week or so. And welcome to Rachel Madley from the Center for Health and Democracy. Tell us about the rules that CMS has proposed and what that's going to mean. Oh, you are muted.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura. And one rule that I wanted to point out to viewers is that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services have proposed shortening the enrollment period for ACA marketplace coverage, meaning that the enrollment period would end 1 month earlier than it normally does. They have also proposed in the same rule to eliminate the monthly special enrollment period that's available to people who have household incomes at or below 150% of the federal poverty level. Now, what this really means is decreasing the opportunities that people have to enroll in ACA health insurance coverage. It would make it harder for people to get the health coverage that they need. And we know very well that when these periods are shortened, people can't enroll, they end up being uninsured and getting very large medical bills and going into medical debt many times. So what I want everyone to know about this is it's just a proposed rule for now. It has not gone into effect. And when CMS proposes this type of rule, it is open for comment, usually for around 30 days. Then they will go through all of the comments that have been submitted and publish a final rule. anyone can submit a comment. These are for members of the public to tell CMS what they think of the rule, what the problems with it may be as people see. And so this rule particularly will open for comment from the public on March 19th. You can submit a comment on the Federal Register, and this rule is titled CMS-9884-P. And so if you feel strongly about the rule proposal, you can go on and submit a comment for about a month before this goes into effect.
Thank you, Rachel. And ending the open enrollment period December 15th, I think, is especially harsh given that's going into the holiday season and people are probably focused on family and other things. And so they're going to miss the deadline. People will miss it if it's December 15th. Contact CMS if you have opinions about these proposed rules. Next, Medicare Advantage plans are known for denying a lot of claims or requiring prior authorization before you can get care. How do you appeal when your Medicare Advantage plan denies your claim or prior authorization?
This is such a great question, and I think it's so important for people to appeal their denials because it is your right as a patient to do so. So in order to appeal a decision by your Medicare Advantage plan, whether they denied your prior authorization, so before you got the service, or whether they denied paying for a claim of a service you already got, you by law are required to receive from them, usually it's called an explanation of benefits, and that contains your denial notice. It also contains how to appeal the decision with your specific Medicare Advantage carrier. For example, if you're on a United Medicare Advantage plan, United will have their own typically website or phone number or address that you will send your appeal to. They will provide instructions on how to do their appeal because it is different for all of the different insurance companies, which I know does add a level of complexity. So if you have questions about how to submit an appeal, feel free to call your insurance company because, again, by law, they have to tell you how to file that appeal. Now, that appeal, if it's for something that was denied as a prior authorization request, they have to get back to you within 30 days with a decision. 30 days is a long time for people, especially if it's a prior authorization for a necessary surgery or for cancer treatment. And so you can add in that you need a fast determination, which would mean that they have to get you an answer within 72 hours. If it is an appeal for a claim that was, you already got the medical service and they're just refusing to pay for it, they have to get back to you within 60 days. Now, one thing to note is if it is a prior authorization that they have denied, your doctor can also submit an appeal on your behalf to the insurance company. If your first appeal is denied, the plan will automatically send your appeal to what's called an independent review entity. So this is a third party that is supposed to be separate from the health insurance company, although there are large companies now that are owned by these big health insurers that conduct these independent reviews. That's a problem that we can discuss another day, but this is sort of the level two of your appeal. You have 60 days from when you get a denial of your first appeal to do this. And so this is the second level. After this level, there is a level three. I'm not going to get into it too much, but if you get another denial from the independent review entity, you can actually request either a hearing or just a decision on your case from the Office of Medicare Hearings and Appeals. If you need more information on that process, it is on medicare.gov. So I encourage you to go look at that process. One thing I want to underscore, you should always be appealing your denials from your health insurance companies. And the reason is more than half of all denials that are appealed in Medicare Advantage plans are overturned. There's a very high level of success in getting these claims denials overturned. And most of the time, it's because the doctor was correct in prescribing the treatment that they did, and your appeal was denied because a health insurer was potentially using artificial intelligence and not properly reviewing your claim or things like that. Unfortunately, only 15% of people who receive a claim denial ever go on to file a formal appeal. So if you take one thing from my answer, always appeal your denials because your doctor knows the care that you need, and more than likely you are going to get that denial overturned.
Thank you, Rachel. So since we're talking about Medicare Advantage, the Medicare Advantage open enrollment period is almost over. It ends March 31st. Are there any qualifying events that let you change plans before open enrollment reopens for Medicare in October? And can Medicare Advantage folks make changes in the open enrollment period in October or only during the Medicare Advantage open enrollment next January?
That's a really great question. So in terms of qualifying life events, yes, there are life events that will trigger a special enrollment period for folks on Medicare Advantage. Those things are similar to the events that start that in ACA coverage, things like that. So if you are losing other coverage that you had, maybe your Medicare Advantage plan contract ended in your area. If you're moving and your plan no longer serves your new area, that can also set up a special enrollment period for yourself. And so when you have those life events happening, it's always important to go on and switch your enrollment because you are able to do that. Other events include a marriage or divorce, other things that would change your health insurance coverage availabilities. Now, in terms of Medicare Advantage folks being able to make changes, they can make changes during the open enrollment period for all of Medicare, which reopens in October. And that's when switches between Medicare and Medicare Advantage can most freely happen. Then there's also the separate Medicare Advantage open enrollment period. And that is when folks who are already on Medicare Advantage could switch to a different Medicare Advantage plan, but you can't do as many changes between traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage. So if you want to make big changes to your coverage, like going from traditional Medicare to Medicare Advantage or vice versa, that needs to be done during the general Medicare enrollment period that begins in October. If you want to make changes just within the Medicare Advantage program, you can also do that during the Medicare Advantage open enrollment period, which is usually from around January to March each year.
Thanks. And so for the people listening, when do you become eligible for Medicare, and what happens if you don't sign up right away?
Another great question, because it's often very confusing when someone is trying to sign up for Medicare because there are so many different options. Plans are all labeled with various letters of the alphabet, so it can become overwhelming. Generally, when you turn 65, you become eligible for Medicare unless you qualify because you have a disability, which also opens your eligibility for Medicare. I'm going to focus on folks who are turning 65. When you turn 65, you have what's called an initial enrollment period. This lasts for 7 months. You can enroll starting 3 months before you turn 65. Your coverage doesn't start until you turn 65, though. And you have until 3 months after you turn 65 to complete your initial enrollment. If you miss your initial enrollment period, you might have to wait to sign up until there's another open enrollment period, and there may be late enrollment penalties. The important part to remember here is there are many folks who are 65 but are still working and still have employer-sponsored health insurance. If you have comparable coverage, so an employer-sponsored health plan that's a group plan, it's available to all of the employees at your job, you do not have to enroll in Medicare during your initial enrollment period, and you won't be subject to late enrollment penalties because you have that coverage. if you don't have that coverage and you have something like an ACA market plan, you have coverage through the VA or COBRA, that does not count. And you do need to enroll in Medicare during your initial enrollment period to avoid paying those late enrollment penalties. So really, you want to enroll starting anytime after 3 months prior to your 65th birthday, up until 3 months after your 65th birthday, unless you have employer-sponsored health coverage. Still, now this is not retiree health coverage from your past employer. This is for folks who are actively working. If you don't have that coverage, make sure you enroll during your initial enrollment period, or you will have some late enrollment penalties.
Thanks, Rachel, and thanks everybody that joined us today. Please text or call in your questions 202-838-6837. Join us next week for more on healthcare in America and your questions answered. And be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out of control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.